You are listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Fusion Patrol Podcast. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we've got a special guest with us. We've got David, who's also going to be helping us look at The Hungry Earth and...
Cold Blood.
Yeah,
thanks for having me.
Good to have you here, David. We thought this episode was big enough that we just needed three people to give us their opinions on it.
Sounds good.
Last episode, we kind of promised a rant from me about errors with the paleontology. And I'm going to kind of skip over that. I'm not going to do it this week. If you want...
Oh, I'm so disappointed.
Well, if you want, I blogged about it over at my blog, and I will put that in the show notes. But just to go over just the minor basics is that... And I'm going to call these creatures the Silurians, because that's what they will forever be to me. But that's clearly a misnomer. And they've basically screwed up every time they've had them on the show. They've called them Silurians, which is far, far too old in the history of life on the planet. They called them Eocenes, which is far, far too new. Nothing makes sense. They know what apes are, but apes haven't evolved yet, even by the Eocene, which is far too new. I mean, it's just a complete mess. And I was kind of halfway hoping that maybe they would try to straighten it out, but instead they actually threw every mistake in again so that it could really confirm it's all wrong. So there's just not much point going on about it. It's a poor name, and I'll post a link to it if you're interested in some of the numbers and why they're wrong. But we'll just move on past that and talk about the episode. So I'm going to start off. I won't put David on the spot. Let's put Ben on the spot first. What do you think?
Well, this was an episode. I would say that the first part left me highly disappointed, especially with the portrayal of the Silurians. I didn't like what I saw. I grew up with classic Doctor Who. I remember the Silurians from the Jon Pertwee era and thought they were just the most fascinating of species that Doctor Who could have thrown at us. And what I got in this last episode just did not it didn't remind me of the creatures that we saw from the classic Doctor Who, and that was only reinforced even more so in this in part two. So in regards to the Silurians alone, I didn't care for it very much. There were other elements. I liked the fact that it was an Earth-based episode. Those can be a lot of fun. And again, I think we touched on this last time. It does sort of harken back to the Pertwee era when he was stranded on Earth. So that was kind of nice. I did enjoy that a great deal. But by the time part two ended, I kind of walked away scratching my head, asking myself, what the heck just happened?
Plus, and because you forgot Rory. So the whole story doesn't make any sense without him.
No, I didn't forget Rory.
Oh, you didn't? Oh.
No.
You know, I'll say, before we ask David about it, I thought that particularly when they were the little Welsh village, I thought that was just a lovely setting. I mean, that was just as classically picturesque, even if they were in the graveyard and whatnot. That was a lovely place to set an episode. That is such a nice change of pace from the cities and even Ledworth, which is a nice town. But, I mean, that's really a charming little village.
Well, again, I think that does harken back to some of the Pertwee episodes when he was stranded on Earth and worked exclusively with the unit. I mean, there were many times. And then once in a while, you'd even see this in the early Tom Baker episodes, going to these little tiny English villages, which I agree, I really like a great deal. There's something very charming that comes into the story whenever a village and the inhabitants come into the story. And in that particular case, for this two-part episode, it did not disappoint. I loved the setting, and I loved the people who lived in the village.
David, how'd you find the episode?
I enjoyed it most overall, but like I said, with the village, I thought that was a nice quaint setting, but the problem with it is the big project they were doing. I mean, you know, we're sitting there going to be breaking a record deeper in Earth than anybody's ever been before. So, you know, where's the press? You know, why isn't this like a big government facility? Why is this in a small village with just a handful of people operating it? That was kind of my big problem with that.
It was a little weird, and they didn't really go anywhere with the, you know, well, we did it because of the blue grass, some stuff that hasn't been found in this part of the country for 20 million years or 10 million years or whatever it was. That didn't really make a whole lot of sense, but then neither did the bluegrass was a warning, and there really wasn't a whole lot of information about why they had been taking the corpses out of the graveyard either. I mean, obviously, it must have been for dissection, but, you know, how many do you need? It's just, you know, there was just some kind of odd stuff. And they did point out that everyone had left for the weekend except for the skeleton crew. So that kind of explained why there weren't many people on the project. But you're right. I mean, there should have been some
Fanfare or something over the event. I mean, if anything.
Yeah. Overall, how did the story work for you?
I thought it was a little weak, especially the first part. I thought it was a little too slow. I mean, going in, I knew it was a two-parter, but I think that the build-up really didn't get to where I expected it to go by the end of the first part. Second part resolved a little bit, but even then, I wasn't happy overall with the story in the long run.
Well, I thought the story was a little bit light, and it was clearly a retread of, in particular, Doctor Who and the Silurians, but also, you know, every other Silurian story that's come after it. And, you know, we could probably pick on the story at some length. But I actually kind of wanted to, you know, say, unless somebody's got some really strong feelings about the story, I kind of wanted to deviate away from that just a little bit and talk about a couple of aspects to it. I mean, one of which is the Silurians and the humans. I don't know if you got this, but there was a strong, almost anti-human sentiment in the Doctor. You know, he blames Ambrose for killing the prisoner. He's, you know, talking about how the humans have to be the best that they can be and must do all this stuff. And really, the Silurians were far nastier. The military Silurians were far worse than anything that was done on the human side. But nary a word of chastisement to them. And it was so one-sided as I was watching it that I just kept, you know, like you've got the prisoner who is locked up, who's practically begging for them to kill her so that she can be a martyr, so she can slaughter you apes and whatnot. And on the bad side, Ambrose, she gets raked over the coals because she tried to get her husband and son and father's lives. You know, it seems like the scale is all wrong there with where the blame should be pointed on this. I don't know if you either of you had that feeling.
Yeah, a little bit. I thought, yeah, because I think since the original Silurian story dealt with unit and the whole soldier, the military aspect, I think they were trying to bring it more to a personal level at this, you know, dealing with just one person.
Mm-hmm. I didn't initially have that thought. I wasn't very happy with the whole portrayal of the Silurians, just personally from a spectator point of view, as a viewer. So it was hard for me to feel any kind of emotional investment regarding how the Doctor was reacting towards the Silurians.
Well, the military ones were just caricatures. I mean, nothing more. They were just, you know, violent military caricature.
Well, so, yeah. now that you brought that up, I'm now going to get on my big gripe. The one thing that I really, really hated about the Silurians is that they were too – and some people are going to really disagree with this, but I really found the portrayal to be far too human. And that bothered me immensely. I never had that sense when we saw the Silurians the two previous times, one in Doctor Who and the Silurians, and then again in Peter Davison, Enemy of the Deep. Enemy from the Deep, was that what it was called? Warriors of the Deep, thank you. You never got that feeling. I mean, even though they had their military cast, there was still something very different. I don't want to use the word alien, but certainly very different than – well, Earthian, yeah. But something certainly very different than what human standards would apply. And yet – and I was really, really tripped out on this when I saw just in the previews, and it was reinforced when I saw part two. It was far too human, their behavior. I mean, you've got this one scientist who's wearing medical clothing and has a hypo. Then you've got this warrior cast that are coming and marching in like they're soldiers, human soldiers. And everything about that just really set me off. And I think it was at that point that I just – I couldn't emotionally invest into this story past that, at least in regards to how the Doctor was relating to the Silurians versus how he was relating to the humans or Ambrose. I just couldn't I couldn't get into it anymore because I couldn't believe in the Silurians.
And they had breasts.
That which, too.
You know, it's just sort of one of those things that defines a mammal.
Yeah, and weren't all the warrior Silurians all female as well?
Yes, they were.
And just the scientist that seemed to be the male.
Yes.
And he was kind of, you know, getting old, getting on in age.
Yeah, and the scientist and the commander of the Silurians were both men. And it wasn't, you know, I mean, the costumes weren't designed in such a way that they could hire a female actress and disguise it. I mean, they could have done a better job if they were trying to make them look non-mammalian sexual in their variation. But, you know, just one of those things. You're right. It makes them more human. It makes them more human to the audience. They're just like us, which, of course, you know, may tie in with the what they were trying to talk about, which, you know, is probably something to do with the British National Party here, or, you know, immigration issues and, you know, that nature. But...
Do you think if they used the original costuming of the original Silurians, they would have still come off as human? More of it's, I think, dealing because we can see the human eyes and the mouth in the draconian type masks that they're using nowadays.
Could be. I don't know. I mean, I didn't care for this interpretation of the Silurians. I think it's kind of weird that every time we see them, basically, there's a different species of Silurian. And so they, you know, that's just their excuse. We've got a whole bunch of them. And, you know, there was the Sea Devil ones, and there was the Silurian ones from the caves of Derbyshire. Now there's this batch. And, you know, how many more there'll be. But a couple things about the Silurians. I'll delve back even to the original story with John Pertwee. The Silurians were largely nasty. I mean, they didn't unleash a virus to try to wipe out the entire human race. The Brigadier did blow them up when they were defenseless, which is might be considered an act of cowardice. But at the same time, they attacked first. And it's almost... And yet, here in this episode, the Doctor is all shamefaced about the fact that the humans blew up the Silurians the last time they found them. Now, you know, no way would I ever be advocating that they should have killed them. But at the same time, it's a perfectly justifiable attack. And so it just kind of bugs me that they don't... The Silurians have so much potential to me. I mean, the Doctor travels in time. He can easily go back in time and have an adventure with the Silurians in their home world, where it's something completely different, where it's not the same story every time. Silurians wake up, Silurians find apes, Silurians must kill apes so that Silurians can take planet back. It's, you know, they've turned them into a one-trick pony, and they don't need to be a one-trick pony. They could be back in their time, and they could be encountering the same kinds of, you know, alien invasion or whatever that we do now in the human, or they could be in the future where the Silurians have come out and merge and integrated with the human race. They could tell a story, and I don't like to use Alien Nation as an example, if anyone even remembers that show, but it's an interesting concept about the integration of one species into another that, and a lot of prejudice and whatnot. And there's a whole bunch of things that they could do, but they don't.
Well, I think they hinted at that at the very beginning of part two. I mean, you're hearing the narration of Eldane as he's talking about 1,000 years in the future, that the doctor, through a terrible, terrible price that he had to pay, did help bring about some form of peace for the Silurians and the humans. So obviously it does happen. Whether they choose to explore that any further, I highly doubt it, because where's the interest in that?
But then did the doctor actually know what happened or a possible future? Because he brought up his whole fixed point of time again and how this one could be changed. So did he already have an outcome in mind or something that he knew from his travels?
I think the doctor is
it's more guilty. Intuitive.
I think it's guilt. I think he feels guilty about the Brigadier blowing up the first time. And he feels guilty about having to blow them up. Or how did they dispatch the Sea Devils? I think they depth charged them, didn't they?
I think they did.
Yeah, and then the doctor had to kill them with poison and Warriors of the Deep. I mean, I think he's feeling guilty about it. Nothing more. It's like, I keep messing these people up, and I shouldn't have to do that.
Yeah, because in Warriors of the Deep, remember, everybody did die except for the Doctor and his companions. So that was, I think, the most death episode of any of the series. So this episode, or two episodes, he kept going on about, hey, nobody's going to die.
Yeah, yeah, and he was wrong. We'll sidetrack a little bit more. Well, we're on track. It has to do with Doctor Who and the Silurians. Now, to me, and I think I mentioned this on the last podcast, Doctor Who and the Silurians was the very first episode of Doctor Who I ever saw. And for example, in paleontology, when you dig up a fossil, a new one, you get to name it. As long as you can make up some bad Latin, Homo reptilia. Oh, wait. Take that back. You could make up some bad Latin, and it doesn't even have to be real Latin. That's why they've got all those Chinese names like Confucius Ornus and what. The rule is it has to kind of sound Latin-y. You get to make up the name. And the bones, and I think everybody knows that, the discovery is the name of it. But one thing that people don't know is that the bones for that particular specimen become what's called the holotype. And this is the specimen that all future specimens are described against. So if for some reason you happen to have an unusually small specimen or an unusually large specimen or an unusually deformed specimen, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the holotype for the Neanderthal man is actually a sort of a crippled arthritic figure. And so for a long time they characterized Neanderthal as stooped over, and where it turns out that's not true. But that's, nonetheless, they never change the holotype. That is the reference species. Doctor Who and the Silurians is the holotype episode or story of Doctor Who. To me, it quite literally is what I measure every other episode of Doctor Who against. Not saying it's the best episode, but that the formulaic components that it put down, the Doctor's attitude, you know, being a brilliant guy, a peace lover, but a capable fighter, intolerant of bureaucrats, having a smart but useful, you know, pretty but useful, smart companion, having evil politicians, and having aliens, Earthians, the Silurians in this case, that aren't exactly, because they weren't in the first one, they weren't two-dimensional monsters, they had their own point of view. That wasn't necessarily evil, and they had their own shades of gray. I mean, these are the components that, to me, I measure every Doctor Who up against. And in that context, you know, this story, which evokes that story quite a lot, doesn't measure up. it doesn't capture Doctor Who in it, even though it is a retread of it in many ways. So, a lot of people thought this episode was paced and just one big loving tribute to the Pertwee era.
It was a bad regurgitation.
Okay, that was actually my opinion on it, too, but I thought we could go on about it. So, David, it's up to you.
I agree exactly the same way.
Oh, yeah. No, this is scary when all three of us agree on this.
Well, you know, that a lot of the stuff everybody's saying is like, oh, it's got the heat barrier like the demons, said, or any other force field.
You can have a bunch of lovely little salutes to previous Doctor Who episodes, but at the end of the day, it has to be all about a very, very interesting and engaging story. If you don't have that, then all the gimmicks in the world aren't going to save it.
Yeah, I just thought the story was okay. I mean, if I gave the impression I disliked it, I liked it. The pacing didn't bother me at all. I think probably most of the Doctor Who episodes should be a couple episodes long. That didn't bother me. I like them building up some tension or even just some mystery as to what's going on in the first part and leave you wanting some more. So I thought the pacing was nice. I thought that was a welcome change to, I think it's Chris Chibnall's previous story, 42. TARDIS lands on spaceship, door slams on, locks him out of the TARDIS. You have 42 minutes or everybody dies. And it's 42 minutes of rush, 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 rush. It's the Doctor against the clock. And if you look at older episodes, Pertwee era, Baker era, a lot of the story was about the discovery, not about resolving the problem. I mean, the problem is obviously there, but they land on the planet, they don't know where they are. They explore the planet, they don't know what's going on. They meet people, they learn things. They meet more people, they learn other things. They get different points of view. They fill in the pieces. It's a story of exploration rather than a story like the modern ones of fighting a disaster. You know, Doctor lands, I'm going to save the universe again. And yet somehow they managed to take this story and do that again. Twice. But once in the first episode where they had 12 minutes to wire up the entire town with all that electronic gear, which I think I timed it, and it took 7 minutes in real time on the show, and they cut out, you know, this is totally fantastical that they would do that in 12 minutes. But, you know, they set up that deadline and rush, 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 and then again in the end where the military was going to start the war. So they can't seem to get out of that paradigm.
Well, I would tend to agree with that. I love the idea of the old classic episodes where it was anywhere from a half to three-fourths of the entire story all about the discovery. And there were some episodes in this season so far where it has had that kind of tone. Most notably, those are the ones that Grand Moff himself have written. When you start getting the other writers in, it becomes more about, you know, we know what the problem is pretty soon on, and then it's all about the conflict. And in some cases, you know, a lot of the allure gets lost for me. So I agree with you on that point.
What would you do, David, if you were going to be doing Doctor Who differently?
Oh, that's a good question, isn't it?
I saved that one just to... When Ben and I got together and started to do this podcast, we have a little sheet of paper that we worked out, and it's got like three or four questions we're going to put to guest hosts that come out of left field, and that was that's question number one.
Well, number one, I would go back. I'd have all episodes be a minimum of a two-parter. That's number one. I mean, you have to have the cliffhangers. You got to lead up to that. 45-minute format, I'm not sure about, but then that could be more up to the BBC, so I don't know how much control one would actually have over that on the show. But I think a lot of it, especially after the RTD era, now we've got all these, you know, the extra clues in here. Now, obviously, we're dealing with the crack. And, you know, that took away 10 minutes of the episode right there at the end of the second part, that they're not being able to use it, the Silurians. I mean, the whole Silurian story is done, and now we're off into another whole adventure for the most part. I don't see that we should be doing that. And like we've had, you know, the Bad Wolf and the Torchwood references in the earlier seasons of the coming back on Doctor Who.
But do you think that the crack has been... I know the crack's been tacked on to the end here. I'm really honestly going to take a slight detour there and say that I am a little annoyed at the Grand Moff, that he couldn't have come up with something other than the crack. Because every time I start talking about Amy's crack or the doctor's crack, it's just like, really? Couldn't he have come up with something other than...
Very sophomoric.
Yeah. Anyway, do you feel that the crack has been a little bit better integrated into the stories, even if it is just at the end of an episode that's a little better integrated than, say, Bad Wolf was?
I would say so on that end, because, I mean, the Doctor's already investigating it, and he kind of knows, or at least he's trying to figure out what's going on, whereas Bad Wolf wasn't resolved until the end of the season. Here, you know, already, you know, the first episode in the 11th hour, he'd already saw it when he first met Amy when she was young. So it's kind of gone from there.
I can understand having it be a vital part of the first episode. I mean, you need to introduce it, but I would agree. It's being tacked on to these other episodes. And what I really dislike, and I really didn't like it in this last episode, is that all of a sudden I felt like I was watching a brand new story. I mean, technically I was. And I think that's what I felt. I walked away with this feeling very, very unsatisfied because, okay, I understand that, yeah, we're trying to build up this overall arc, and I kind of wish we didn't have to have one. It'd be nice if we could have a whole series, a whole Doctor Who season where we didn't have one. But tacking on the way they did, I felt like we were doing – they felt like – they were doing something of a disservice to an already weak episode to begin with, and then to not even fully address it. I mean, you've got Amy, who is now she's completely forgotten who Rory is, but there's that ring. And remember, Eugene, the last time you and I talked about this, we were wondering what was the whole purpose of Rory putting the ring in the console. Yeah. That was going to figure out, and somehow putting it in the console protected it, kept it from vanishing along with everything else that was Rory.
Well, that's a good question. Is the ring Rory, or you start? Oh,
that's too Flash Gordon.
If you start analyzing the idea of disappearing from history, it falls apart very quickly. Because, for example, if Rory was never around, then Rory never took the pictures of Prisoner Zero in his coma forms. And if he never took the pictures in his coma forms, he never had them on his BlackBerry. And if he never had them on his BlackBerry, then the Doctor never got it, and the Doctor was never able to transmit it to the aliens whose name I've forgotten completely, but the jailers of Prisoner One. And so the Doctor never saved the Earth, and how... You know, what does Amy remember about that?
I know.
How did the Doctor save the day?
It's a very, very bad effort at rewriting history. I mean, at least I can give a tip of the hat to RTD in that. Did he write Left Turn?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay. Well, at least he wrote one episode where a simple little action can have gargantuan consequences. And here you are, you're erasing a person from all of history. It has got to have enormous ramifications.
Could cause a crack.
Right, yeah. and we're not seeing that.
And doesn't it completely take away from Amy's choice, that whole episode?
Yes.
I mean, that just – it ruins that whole thing now, and the whole Dream Lord sequence and everything.
And it kind of takes away from Vampires of Venice.
Which didn't have much to take away from it to begin with.
No.
So yeah, it's definitely it's one of those timey-wimey things that we're not gonna get to explore. So I had previously been thinking about it, and and I'm somewhat wrong, maybe not, but I think I'm probably off base now. But I was starting putting the pieces together and saying, you know, we've been led all along to believe that Amy's wedding day is the problem, which of course now doesn't even exist, but or is not a planned wedding day, I assume, unless she's got a different fiancé in this new revised timeline. But that, you know, it's been presented to us as Amy's bedroom. It's Amy's this, it's Amy's that, it's Amy's crack, basically. And the pieces that we're starting to put together, like Rory's not really surprised when he walks inside the TARDIS for the first time. And, oh, they give that throwaway line like, well, I've been reading a lot of science. Well, you can read science all day on this planet. And
you're going to be surprised when you walk inside that TARDIS. And it doesn't matter how much science fiction or how much you study relativity, you're going to walk inside the thing and you're going to say, oh, my God, it's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
Your jaw is going to drop. It has to. It has to. And so it's almost like maybe Rory's been in the TARDIS before, you know, and so the shock isn't there anymore. Or, which, you know, has that got something to do with his tag being 10 years out of date on the thing? Like, and suddenly I start thinking, well, it's not Amy's wedding day. It's Rory's wedding day. It's, you know, maybe this is Rory's crack, which is even more sophomoric.
I'm sorry. I tried not to laugh at that, but I couldn't help it.
Now that
if you'll remember earlier also, is that the Amy doesn't remember the Daleks either from when they supposedly invaded. So maybe that ties in somehow with this, with everything being erased in her past.
Yes. Yes, I suspect.
So it's more about Amy than, because we had originally thought it was going to be a lot about Amy. Then we started to think maybe it's more about Rory, but now it's more about Amy again. But still,
one remembers the Daleks on Earth. You know, I mean, it's just with Amy's the only person the doctor's ever actually put that to. But that doesn't mean that everyone on Earth is unremembering?
Forgetting.
Unremembrance of the Daleks.
That's it.
That is a title, episode title.
Yeah, because I would certainly like to unremember that episode. But still, I going back to the whole Rory thing, here we've been given all these funky little what we thought were clues, and as far as we can see now, it was all for nothing. And that kind of pisses me off because I've been investing some time into something that was nothing more than one gigantic red herring.
What do you think the odds are that Rory will be back by the time the Pandorica opens?
Actually, I think the odds are pretty good.
Yeah, I agree with that. Remember, time can be unwritten now in the new series, according to the Doctor.
History can be rewritten.
And here's another possibility. The fish people came through one of the cracks. Prisoner Zero came through one of the cracks. Perhaps the clerics and Rory went through the crack and are somewhere else. I mean, now, admittedly, Rory was kind of shot and dying or possibly dead at that moment. Maybe when it reaches out with its tendrils and grabs you and pulls you through, it's not just erasing you. It's taking you through to the other side.
And the Doctor reached through, and the TARDIS is sitting right there, obviously. I mean, it's destroyed.
It's only part of it.
Yeah. Of course, do you think maybe the TARDIS has already gone through the crack and we're on the other side right now?
It's possible. I mean, we don't know what happened after the regeneration, really. I mean, we saw the Doctor hanging out the door and playing Charlie Chaplin or Harold Lloyd, I guess, and smashing a crack. And maybe he did fall through something.
I mean, the TARDIS obviously doesn't sense it because, like in Victory of the Daleks, you know, when they take off at the end, the crack is sitting right there 2 feet away, and they were oblivious to the whole thing, so...
Yeah, so the idea that this is a parallel universe would also fit in with Amy not knowing anything about the Daleks.
So the Doctor fell through one of those cracks. Yeah, that's not a bad theory.
I think they've definitely got us running around in circles now, which is probably their plan.
And I'm sure that the result will be nothing like what we're guessing.
That's it for this week, unless anybody wants to add anything.
No, I'm good.
I'm good, thank you.
All right, David, and we will probably have you back someday.
Sounds good.
All right, and until next time, see you later.
Fusion Patrol is produced by Lone Locust Productions. You can contact us at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.